Hello, I'm Fred Stella, President of the Interfaith Dialogue Association. Welcome to another edition of Common Threads. One of the hallmark events of the Interfaith Dialogue Association is the Rabbi Philip Siegel Memorial Lecture. This talk was named after one of the pioneers of interfaith relationships here in West Michigan. Philip Siegel was a progenitor of what became the Interfaith Dialogue Association. His widow, Dr. Lillian Siegel, was a co-founder and president of IDA until her move to the Philadelphia area 2 decades ago. Earlier this year, we brought in Reverend Jennifer Bailey, an ordained African Methodist Episcopal minister and emerging interfaith leader nationally. Her talk, Racial and Interfaith Justice, A New Vision for Leadership at the Intersections, featured inspiring stories from her own growing up, the tragedy of the killings at the AME Church in Charleston, and her own faith journey. Please sit back now and enjoy part one of our Siegel Lecture, Racial and Interfaith Justice.
Many of you know that the Siegel Lectureship has been going on for a number of years, and this is the first year that we're combining the Siegel Lecture, which has been sponsored by the Interfaith Dialogue Association, with a Kauffman event. And that's because the IDA, the Interfaith Dialogue Association, and the Kauffman Institute have now merged. We are one organization. We are so pleased to have the Interfaith Dialogue Association a part of the Kauffman Interfaith Institute. And I'm going to ask Fred Stella to come and say a few words about the Siegel Lectureship, which will be followed by the introduction to our speaker by Katie Gordon, who is the program manager for the Kauffman Interfaith Institute. Fred?
Thank you very much, Doug. Rabbi Philip Siegel was an amazing man. I don't know if I'd be able to say that we wouldn't be here without him, but I'm pretty confident in saying that if he did not exist here in Grand Rapids, that the interfaith community would not have coalesced as quickly as it did at the time that it did. I wish I'd had more interactions with the gentleman. He was, I believe, unique. He came here about 3 decades ago, a little over 3 decades ago, and he was the rabbi for the conservative Ahavas Israel Synagogue for a few years. And in that time, he really started to stir the interfaith pot. He himself was a New Testament scholar. He believed that if you wanted to understand first century Judaism, you had to understand some parts of the New Testament. And he was all about bringing people together. He had very small conferences at the synagogue. And I remember one that I attended. And again, these were not attended by large numbers of people, but I do remember one panel that I'd heard about, and it was really dipping my toe into the interfaith scene. There was a Catholic, a Protestant, and a Jew. They were really walking on the wild side back then. That's about as interfaith as things got. And I remember that there was something, there was a twinkle in his eye, there was a bit of a joie de vivre about him, and I knew I could get away with this. Again, I did not know him, but during the Q&A, people were talking about Jews going to churches to teach churches how to put on Passover Seders, which is a really wonderful tradition. And so after a bit of Q&A on that, I raised my hand and I asked the rabbi, I said, you know, it's wonderful that Jews are doing this, going to Christian churches and teaching them how to do Seder. But I said, you can only go so far until you also have to teach them not to make pastrami sandwiches on white bread with mayonnaise. And he looked at me, he laughed, and he said, you're not from around here, are you? I was a recent transplant from Detroit, and he says, yeah, that works now. So anyway, we are very excited, as Doug mentioned, the Interfaith Dialogue Association. We are now a part of Kauffman Interfaith Institute. For the past few years, the Siegel Lecture has been a biannual event, and we are going to do our very utmost to make sure that this is an annual event from this point forward, so that this man, Philip Siegel, who worked so hard to accomplish what we are in the process of accomplishing, that memory doesn't fade. I don't have any other recollections. I can't even tell you what the conference at the synagogue was about that year. All I know is at the end, the Christian, the Protestant, the Catholic, and the Jew left the synagogue, walked into a bar, and hilarity ensued. So thank you very much for coming here. And now Katie Gordon will do the introductions.
I'm not Katie Gordon. I don't remember if I introduced myself or not, but I'm Doug Kinchy, the director of the Kauffman Interfaith Institute. And before Katie introduces our Siegel lecture, I want to acknowledge earlier today we recognized the 2016 Interfaith Leadership Awardee. And he's with us tonight, and I want to acknowledge again and introduce, although I don't think any of you need introduction, to our former mayor, George Hartwell, who has been a great supporter of interfaith activity. And George, would you please stand and be acknowledged again? Now the real Katie Gordon will come forward.
Hi, everyone. As Doug said, I'm the program manager of the Kauffman Interfaith Institute, and I have the pleasure of introducing my friend Jen Bailey tonight. Named one of the 15 faith leaders to watch in 2015, Reverend Jennifer Bailey is an ordained minister, community organizer, and emerging national leader in the multi-faith movement for justice. As the founder and executive director of the Faith Matters Network, Jennifer believes that people of faith can be game changers in the fight to build a more just, compassionate, and peaceful world. She comes to this work with nearly a decade of experience combating intergenerational poverty in her hometown of Chicago and in her adopted home of Nashville, Tennessee. A child of the food justice movement, Jennifer worked to increase access to public benefits for food insecure families in Middle Tennessee and organized residents of food deserts to advocate for transformational public policies in their communities. After years of listening deeply to the stories of community members living with hunger, Jennifer realized that the immediate issue of food insecurity was a symptom of a much larger issue, structural economic injustice. At the same time, she noted that the regions of the county with the greatest economic disparities are also the areas with the highest rates of religious participation in the United States. And the Faith Matters Network was born. A Truman Scholar, Jennifer earned degrees from Tufts University and Vanderbilt University Divinity School. She is an ordained elder in the African Methodist Episcopal Church, in the oldest historically black denomination in the United States. And on a more personal note, since we're both alumna of the Interfaith Youth Corps, I got to meet Jen over 2 years ago, and it's been a joy and inspiration to follow the work that she does in Nashville and nationally across the country. The leadership that she's provided for fellow interfaith advocates across the country as she helps articulate this field as real justice work makes her a leading voice in our movement, and I'm so excited for her to share some of those stories and lessons with all of you tonight. So with that, please help me welcome Jen to the stage.
Good evening. Can y'all hear me okay? I now live in the South, so I say y'all. So, first, I just want to say thank you so much for the invitation. I have been so deeply moved by the people that I've had the opportunity to interact with this afternoon, to hear the stories, the deep stories of interfaith work that's happening in Grand Rapids, from the year of interfaith understanding to the year of interfaith service. My heart got a little pitter-patter, y'all. And also, thank you so much to my home folks, my peoples, to the local AME Church for your award. I feel so grateful, and I feel grateful to be with you all tonight. I'm a storyteller, so instead of standing behind the podium, I'm going to tell some stories tonight. Stories about the intersection of interfaith and racial justice. My story begins at the confluence of the Mississippi and Ohio rivers. In geography, confluence is used to refer to the meeting of two great bodies of water. Often, when you see from above the confluence of rivers, it's an interesting sight. They either remain separate, each with their own distinct colors and sediments, or they begin to blend together. In the spring of 1950, my grandmother, Harriet, got off a Greyhound bus at the confluence of the Mississippi and Ohio rivers in Cairo, Illinois. She was from a little town in northern Florida called Quincy, Florida, a town at that time which had been facing some pretty serious issues. You see, when my grandmother was growing up in the 1930s and 40s in northern Florida, it wasn't a safe place for a little black girl. In 1943, as Hitler's bombs rained down over Germany, my grandmother woke up at 9 years old to hear news that one of her neighbors had been lynched and left, sprawled out on a bridge in town. My grandmother was escaping at that time what I would call a state of racial terrorism in the South, a state of racial terrorism which limited her opportunities because of who she was embodied to be, limited opportunities to economic growth, to educational access. So she boarded that Greyhound bus, leaving behind the land that her grandfather had tilled for years. The land and the red dirt clay where she had grown up, where her grandfather had built a little church that she worshiped in every Sunday. She boarded that bus believing that she could have a better future in the North and became part of the story of the Second Great Migration. Now, when she got off that bus in Cairo, Illinois, she didn't know that 3 years later, at the confluence of those rivers, my mother would be born. My mother, Christine, born in 1953, was a new generation of young African American. She grew up the first integrated class in her high school in 1968. For those of you who are students of history, you know that the Brown decision happened over a decade later. But sometimes in our narratives of history, we forget that equality and justice takes a while to move. When my mother walked into her high school the first day, she was greeted with National Guardsmen in her small southern Illinois town, because there had been bomb threats in her city. She became a part of a generation of young people who went to college, Southern Illinois University, go Salukis. Then moved north to Chicago with the promise of a brighter future. That's where she met my dad. And several years later, as happens, I was born. And we moved to another river town, Quincy, Illinois. From Quincy, Florida to Quincy, Illinois. Right up that river. I was born in 1987. I am a millennial. I have no memory of the Soviet Union. I don't know a time in my life when there wasn't a personal computer somewhere nearby. But I began school in 1992. The same year that Rodney King captured the national imagination and started a new type of conversation of what race relations would be like in the United States.
You are listening to Common Threads on WGVU Radio. Today we are broadcasting part one of the annual IDA Philip Siegel Memorial Lecture that was delivered at Grand Valley State University in the spring of 2016. It was delivered by Reverend Jennifer Bailey. It's entitled Racial and Interfaith Justice, a New Vision for Leadership at the Intersections.
Now, Quincy, Illinois, while a great opportunity for my college-educated parents, was a difficult place to grow up. It was 95% white, 5% all other. And one of my earliest experiences in my school was being told that I was dirty, because why else would my skin be brown? That early experience of direct racism endowed of me a sense of deep empathy for those who are other. So it was no surprise when I moved to Chicago from high school in 2001, September of 2001, that when the Twin Towers came down and I saw on the TV screen that people who were brown like me were suddenly our enemies, I thought the one place that I would hear a message of hope, a message of unity, would be that church, my church, which for me growing up was the one place where it felt safe to be brown like me and embodied like me in the world. But that's not what I heard from my pulpit. What I heard is that Muslims were our enemies. That there was something fundamentally wrong with them. That was not the gospel that I knew. That was not the gospel that I felt in my heart. So I sought alternative opportunities for my theological education, not knowing at that point that I would eventually go to seminary. But I was curious, so I kept probing and asking questions. Those questions led me to an organization called Interfaith Youth Corps. I became one of their first young people, an IFYC OG, as they call us now. And I got to know people like Adina, a conservative Jew from my rival high school in Chicago. She told me about the Torah and how she was going to take a year off to study it in Israel. Mostly we talked about prom dresses and graduation. But at a time when I was wrestling with my own faith identity, Adina became a force for me to think about my own text again, to think about my own faith again. I met people like Umar, a Pakistani Muslim who loved hip-hop as much as me. And as we were doing service together, I got to know about Islam as a religion of peace. And my eyes and my ears and my heart was opened to what the world could look like in an era where rainbow-colored codes were dictating our levels of safety, in an era where war was raging and tearing apart communities, not just abroad, but in the low-income communities that my people lived in. Beloved, I believe that we are at a confluence moment. We know that religious diversity in the United States has never been higher. Harvard professor Diana Eck talks about America being perhaps the most religiously diverse nation in human history. That force is meeting us at the same time that America is becoming more racially diverse than ever before. Two mighty forces coming together. The question is whether or not they will become intricately woven in seamlessly into the narrative of what it means to be an American, or if, as the news would have you believe, we are destined to be divided. Now, I firmly believe that to understand the phenomena of what's happening today, we have to begin to explore these issues at the intersections, at the confluence of our identity. I stand today not just as a Black woman, although that's important to me, but as a daughter, as a child of the Midwest, as an expat in the South, and most of all, as a minister of the gospel of Jesus Christ. No one identity speaks over and above the other. When I come to the table working on issues of justice, I have to bring the fullness of who I am to the table. Now, I believe that we are at a critical moment in our nation's history when presidential candidates can gain votes by saying that they will register Muslims. When violence is applauded at rallies, when young black and brown people stand up and claim that they matter, we're at a pivotal turning point. And I believe that as people of faith, as beloved of God, we have the tools and the resources to begin modeling something new. Now, I'm going to be real with you all. We're living in some dark times, some dark days, dark days, dark days. In the Christian tradition, we just finished up our Holy Week. Easter Sunday was last Sunday. And I've been thinking a lot about what happens before Easter Sunday during Holy Week. You have Good Friday, you have this traumatic moment where Christ is crucified. But then you have the silence of Holy Saturday. Christ is dead. We don't know what's coming. We don't know if he's coming back. I think we're in a Holy Saturday moment right now. A moment where it's not clear what direction we're heading or going. But I believe we have the tools and the resources to embody what I call a theology or ethic of accompaniment with communities that need it the most at this time. For me, the theology of accompaniment or ethic of accompaniment is deeply Christian. It's based in my sacred text. When I think about the theology or ethic of accompaniment, I think about a Bible scripture I used to quote during Sunday school. For those of you who've participated in youth group activity, sometimes you're pointed at and asked to recite a Bible scripture. And what happens when you don't know what Bible scripture to say? You say, "Jesus wept." The shortest verse in the Bible, the words "Jesus wept," are often pivoted to when you can't remember what else to say. I believe in a theology of accompaniment for showing up for people who are different than us. Jesus wept actually has a lot to teach us. You see, in the biblical narrative, in the Christian narrative, Jesus wept comes at a time when Lazarus is dead, Jesus' close friend. Mary and Martha, his sisters, are upset. Jesus gets there late. And they say, "If you had been here, my brother would still be alive." And instead of raising Lazarus immediately, Jesus sits with them and Jesus weeps with them. Theologically, I've been sitting with this a lot because I've been crying a lot the past year, y'all. I've been crying when news of another unarmed black man being shot and killed enters my news feed on Facebook and Twitter, I'm one of y'all. When videos of death go viral over and over and over and over and over and over again, I lean into Jesus wept because I have to believe that as a Christian, Jesus wept means that Jesus is with me in the midst of my grief. There's a lesson for us in that. When communities are in a place of deep lament, when we don't know what to do or say, sometimes what's required is our presence, is our accompaniment, is the breaking open of our heart to feel in the deepest wells of our soul that grief. The good news in the biblical narrative is that Jesus does raise Lazarus from the dead. It's a good end to the story. But that pause, that moment of grief, is one of the most important moments, I think, in teaching us what an ethic of accompaniment can look like. When I think about a theology or ethic of accompaniment in this moment, in this tense, this dark, dark moment, I look to examples from other faith traditions. I look at the example of Fatima Knight. Who's Fatima Knight, you say? In June of last year, many of us will remember, June 18th, it was a Wednesday, I remember, because before I went to bed, I checked Twitter, as any good millennial does, and I saw news pouring out of Charleston, South Carolina. There had been a shooting at an AME church. As news scrolled across my news feed, I found out more details. I found out that it was at Mother Emmanuel AME Church. Mother Emmanuel, a historic church in my denomination, which was known as a bastion of civil rights, which was known as historically living into the ethic and the narrative of my faith tradition.
You have been listening to part one of Racial and Interfaith Justice, A New Vision for Leadership at the Intersections. This was our Philip Siegel Memorial Lecture for 2016, and it featured Reverend Jennifer Bailey. Please join us again for part two of this inspiring talk next week here on Common Threads. This is WGVU, and I'm Fred Stella.